All lines are now bridge.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the TEFCA task force here. Of the members, we have John Kansky, Carolyn Peterson, Cheryl Turney, Sasha Termott, Anil Jain, Andrew Truscott, David McCauley, Mark Savage, and Laura Kahn. Are there any other members that joined that I didn't call? Okay. So I think we're just going to pick up on our discussion around security provisions, but I'll turn it over to John for any opening remarks.
To frame for the group that we're picking up, working down the matrix where we left off, but I think first Zoe has an introduction to make. Zoe?
Yeah, hi everyone. So I just wanted to briefly introduce Jonathan Coleman, who is going to be joining us today on the call. Jonathan is a principal at Security Risk Solutions, and he consults for ONC around security. So he will be on the call today to answer any fact-based questions that we have. And Jonathan, if you could just say hey so people can hear your voice.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you, Zoe. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for participating. So with that, as displayed on the screen, we left off yesterday with CUI, or Controlled Unclassified Information, and then the hope for the day is to finish out the remaining discussion items on the rest of the matrix, which if you're counting is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, although some of those we kind of covered yesterday. They do all loosely have to do, or not so loosely, have to do with security. So appreciate Jonathan being here as a resource. With that, the CUI, or the Controlled Unclassified Information, is discussed in 6.2.1. 6.2.1, and I think there was some questions about, I know this is, dealing with CUI is a factor of great interest in dealing with federal agencies, whether the suggestions in the draft TEF 2 are consistent with what the federal agencies would require, and that's the second bullet, is the requirement sufficient to allow federal agencies to participate. We would certainly want that to be the case. If there's any, are there questions among the task force? Are there folks that are unfamiliar with the controlled unclassified information? What that is and why it represents, why it's singled out.
Sorry, John.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead, David.
I was just going to ask Jonathan if he had a good summary of what CUI inclusion in this might mean different from what it was like in the past, that, you know, just to kind of update us on what's the impact of this. And then a second question, more practical maybe, is whether or not there are other issues that we ought to be worried about for participation of, for example, VA and DOD around something like certificate policy and the ability to participate in networks that involve non-federal partners. That was an issue in the past. I'm not sure, maybe it's been resolved, but I know in the early days of DIRECT, it was difficult to get an agreement on our certificate policy to allow HISP to connect both inside and outside federal agencies.
Yes, thank you very much. On the latter point, I believe that was resolved, but I don't have that information to hand, but we can certainly research that and get back to you if that's helful. But I do recall the Federal Health Architecture Work Group discussing that and including that as one of their topics in their risk assessment. Regarding the controlled and classified information, so there's an executive order which requires the appropriate safeguarding of controlled and classified information, and, you know, to the point in hand about is the requirement in the test sufficient to allow federal agencies to participate. I think from a QHIN to QHIN perspective, if the QHINs are going to be safeguarding the information to the same standards that federal agencies require their contractors, then that should be sufficient. And I believe that that requirement is NIST 800-171, which is the control set which would be used for safeguarding controlled and classified information. But I don't want to speak on behalf of the agencies. I think they'll have to make that determination. But at least as far as the QHIN to QHIN exchanges go, I do believe that this should be consistent with their existing requirements.
So this is John. Not to oversimplify this one, and so, but to perhaps to try and we already have Andy's got his hand up, so I'm going to shut up and let Andy talk.
No, you carry on, John. Just very quickly, who would be policing that attestation between the QHINs?
So I don't know the answer to that. So I'll have to defer to Zoe on that one. I don't know if there's a self-attestation or any other kind of policing, but I should think it would be consistent with how other type of policing is done as in terms of attestation.
Right. The RCE would manage any kinds of attestation and policing of those requirements.
I get that, but who would, so it would be a self-attestation, and then the RCE would collate those attestations to say these QHINs are performing appropriately and adequately.
Right, so we don't get into that level of specificity in the MRTCs. That would likely be something that the RCE would add to the ARTCs, and we can, if we want to do a recommendation for the RCE to put something in like that in the ARTCs, that would be great.
Yeah, I think that would be good.
Okay, so, and this is, go ahead.
So it's David. If we don't have more questions from other people, I can give us some more to talk about. I don't know. Are we using
the
hand? Okay. Well, it's not. It's been again back to sort of what does CUI mean, and I'm concerned. For example, would it affect the data that's included in summary records that are exchanged through QHINs, for example, even if the patient or citizen was not in active service or being solicited by federal agencies. So could you end up with, you know, sort of a strange situation that you have to form your CDA summary records differently if the request is coming from or going to a federal agent? I guess I'm really asking if we have any idea about what maybe some of the unintended consequences of CUI, or maybe they're intended consequences, but not yet explored consequences of adding these CUI requirements, which just, I don't have a good sense of what they actually mean.
Yeah, I don't want to imply I have any experience or more knowledge than I have in this area. I think unexplored may, and I'm openly appealing to any on the phone that want to comment. But I believe this is a new executive order. It's causing organizations. My frame of reference is working with the eHealth Exchange, saying, okay, the federal government has new requirements related to handling CUI. They're holding out NIST 800-171 as the standard, there's a little bit of scrambling. May not, this is the first word that came to mind, to try and say, okay, is that reasonable? Can we make the federal agencies comfortable and happy with the compliance with their expectations? and at the same time have it be implemented in a way that doesn't make things overly difficult. I don't know that that question is answered or if people on the phone have a opinion. So there you have it. I think...
No, I'm pausing and thinking, John.
I'll pause longer.
This is Jonathan. If it's helpful, I put in the chat the link to the definition of the CUI category of health information as posted by National Archives.
Yeah, I'm looking at it. I don't know that I'm going to be able to take this in and comment intelligently on the fly.
Yeah. I looked at it before. I couldn't figure it out.
So, David, is your is your concern that I'm going to start wordsmithing a little bit in my brain. Given that this is unexplored, we want to make sure that whatever is in TEFCA 1 is consistent with what the federal agencies are requiring so that we don't create a barrier to the sharing of information. 2, that it's implementable in a way that doesn't create an obstacle or burden that I think you were alluding to. We don't really know what that recommendation means. But it wouldn't hurt to say something like that. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, the broader concern, and it's based a little bit on the experience in the early days of Direct, was that in effect the differing requirements created a two-tier network, which defeats the purpose of having a bridging network if there's two tiers. The goal would be, I guess, in my mind's eye, to make sure that these requirements don't have the unintended side effect of creating a two-tier network. You're either talking to a federal partner or you're not, and having to do everything differently if you are or aren't talking to a federal partner. So just walking through the details to make sure that doesn't happen would be, I guess, my recommendation. That's all I know right now. I don't know. I wish I could be more specific.
And I'll make the comment that this is maybe going to morph into the discussion of the next, and I want to admit my degree of ignorance going into that is security tagging. I know is potentially a way of dealing with CUI, and that's our next topic that's dealt with in TEFCA. But I see that. Andy has his hand up. Andy?
Yeah, hey, John, I was just going to suggest that maybe we defer this for the time being and give us all this opportunity to explore both the link that Jonathan posted and the child link from that I posted that's the actual handbook. Honestly, I'm inclined to not make too much of a big thing of this. It's just document marking it, and it's pretty explanatory and pretty well defined. And has been done in other jurisdictions before.
Thank you. So thank you, whoever, Excel or whoever that captured the recommendation, and that will guarantee that we poke the group for further discussion when we get to draft recommendations. As Andy suggested, encourage those folks to read up a little bit and think in case that comes up with elicits a deeper comment. With that, I'm going to suggest we transition to security tagging. I think I was the one who offered the example of CUI only because that's the time I'd heard it associated, but I don't want to imply that I know more than I do. So referencing where this appears in TEFCA, it's in the, I don't know what to call that section. It's not exactly preamble, but it was in my copy. It's on security labeling on pages 19 and 20. And I believe it's just a request. ONC is requesting comment, if I recall. Does anyone from ONC, oh, wait, we have hands up. David, you're in the queue, followed by Sasha.
Yeah, so the way I read the language, and I'll admit I read it a while ago and haven't reread it based on our recent conversation, so I may be slightly out of sync here, but is that it was tagging of sensitive materials, but not a whole lot of other requirements on what those tags would cause to happen downstream. And as if that's the way it was structured, I think that makes good sense to defer the complexity of how to handle the security tags to actual implementation choices based on the RCE and interaction with the stakeholders in the context of a very difficult technical problem and sort of rapidly evolving standards that need to be fleshed out before they're, you know, forced on everybody. If that's the spirit of it here, to say start with tagging and then figure out what to do about that later, then I think that makes sense. I would restate, though, that the broad-scale experiments on detailed, complex handling of downstream structured tagged data is an unexplored space. The little bit of work that's been done has not been done at scale. So I think it'd be very wise not to overcomplicate the technical specs at this point, and just state that it's a policy goal that it be supported as incrementally in the future as the standards evolve and permit it.
Reading from
I misread that. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, yeah,
go
reading
ahead,
from the draft, too, it's I'm pulling a couple things out of context. ONC is considering the inclusion of a new requirement regarding security labeling, therefore, we, meaning ONC, have limited the proposed requirement to four of the most commonly requested sensitive data categories, and ONC is requesting public comment. There was also a statement earlier in the paragraph that said, currently, security labels can be placed on data to enable an entity to perform access control, blah, blah, blah. I had no experience with what current security labeling industry experience is. And that sounds like, David, you're referring to that.
John, what page was that?
On my copy, it's 19, but I think I have an earlier version. It might be 20 on other.
No, it's page 18, and it's also up on the screen if people can see it.
Thank you.
One additional comment, if I can piggyback on the end of mine before we go further. It always struck me that you need to solve the provenance tracking first before you attempt layering on complex behaviors that are related to the security. You need to know where the data is coming from because that will affect what you're allowed to do with the data. So I'm a little surprised that provenance doesn't take a prior role here, get a higher priority, and then add security tagging in the context of provenance, because those two go hand in glove in my mind. But I'll stop there.
Thank you. And Sasha's been waiting patiently. Sasha?
Oh, yes. So I was thinking of this discussion of security labeling and also some of the conversation we had in the committee about the proposed data segmentation standards in respect to the other rule. And I think some of the same concerns that the committee articulated about the standards in that proposal would still be true, right? There's a lot of technical work to be done to implement them. There's a lot of governance work that would have to be clarified to move the industry forward. Kind of like David said, there's not wide-scale implementations of this type of tagging and what the implications are, and some of that has to still be figured out. Overall, I thought that the scope prioritization that ONC proposes here to say, what if we picked a specific value set and labeled documents that contain something within that value set, is, in my mind, a much more practical place to start than the broad scope of the standard as proposed in certification. But so I think this is the thinking here, I think is a good direction. However, since the committee proposed that there be a task force that looked into the implementation of data segmentation in general, that was one of our recommendations with respect to the other rule, it seems to me that we should refer to that same recommendation here. And to say that, you know, we recognized previously that there could be value to this work, but there's a lot of complexity there, and that perhaps that work group that we recommended be formed in the other recommendation would evaluate the thinking ONC has here as a possible starting place as they would do their analysis.
Thank you. That makes great sense. So to repeat, and it looks like it's getting captured, is that while the recommendation in TEF 2 is, in your view, reasonable, that we want to call out that information blocking task force has recommended a separate group to look into data segmentation, and that we want those to be consistent and perhaps recommend that that work group take a look at what's in TEF 2.
Yeah, and just to maybe qualify slightly my assessment that this is reasonable, with security labeling, I think there's two or three different areas that have to be thought about. One is, how do you apply the labels? One is, what do you do when you receive something that's labeled? And the third is, how do we handle like governance or disputes about labeling? And so the proposal that ONC has made here addresses the first one. It would be easier to apply labels if we could do it programmatically by saying, oh, anything with a particular code in this value set should be labeled in a particular way. And that resolves a lot of like the workflow concerns about the burden of labeling and so forth. However, this doesn't, and I think David was saying appropriately, although I think someone has to make a decision about it, this doesn't say what you do when you receive something that's labeled. And nor does it sort of clarify how the RCE or other entities would govern any sort of disputes about, hey, you sent me something that's labeled, but I don't know what that label means. Now what happens? And so I do think there's still significant further work that would have to be done. Even though this is a practical way to address a portion of the challenges, it's not, it doesn't make the whole implementation, I guess, ready to go, if that makes sense.
Thank you. This may be inviting Jonathan to comment. Is 800-171, does it speak to security labeling as part of CUI? And I know I'm kind of mushing two things together. Or is 800-171, is it silent on security tagging?
Yeah, so for the most part, it's silent on security tagging. What 171 is, it's a list of security controls that an organization can implement in order to help protect the computing environment with which the health information is flowing. So it's actually a subset of NIST 800-53, which is what the federal agencies currently use for their authorization processes. And this subset of controls has been selected as a tailored set by NIST to be deemed to be applicable to the healthcare environment. So it's not specific to tagging. It contains a number of different security controls, and they vary, and they include things like including a warning banner or a logon banner, those kinds of things. So it's not specific to security labeling.
Got it. So it's much more general to security best practices.
That's correct.
Thank you. David and then Andy. You guys are my best customers.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what I raised my hand about. I think I want to just agree with everything Sasha said. I think the stuff is far more complicated than it appears on the surface. You know, one thing is if you have labeling but no actions required, you're kind of marking the records and says, here's the juicy stuff, you know, because you're identifying the things that somebody thought were especially sensitive, but you don't have any policy rules on what that means in terms of how you treat the data downstream, which might have a completely unintended consequence from someone who's concerned about privacy. So I think it needs a lot more study before it's baked into the MRCs or what MRTCs, whatever we call these things. Let the work groups figure it out, and then the RCE work with stakeholders to gradually
Thank
move
you.
Us forward.
And I see that we captured Sasha's list of 1, 2, 3 things, which I thought was a good framing. So thanks to both of you. Andy.
So just to pile on with the Sasha Appreciation Society, then yes, I agree with everything Sasha said, and David, actually, as well.
I agree with you, Andy.
Obviously. I do think that this is an area that has been explored elsewhere before. I think we are getting to it here, partially in the US, because of where we are now, in terms of our overall posture around enabling computing. And so with that increasing level of concern over, well, okay, what are the what-if scenarios where we might not wish to share all information, and how can a provider best control that? You know, Sasha and David both talked about, you know, tagging data is very hard. And expecting the standards to just make that magically happen without further work is definitely needed, I think, in my opinion. The HITACH did suggest to ONC a task force to be created to enable that to be looked at further, and I think we absolutely need to look at that. I would be tempted to allow TEF to carry on and have kind of a placeholder for this as it comes across and gets defined better. John, that would be my suggestion at this point.
Thank you. And you guys can laugh if this is funny, but is there a nationally accepted standard for security tagging, or is that why we're talking about this as largely unexplored, because there is no such thing?
There's no such thing. There's namespace is available for it in some of the messages over time. And I keep saying other jurisdictions. So the UK went through this around the whole concept called Secure Olympics. They had a bunch of messages.
Hey, Andy. Yes. Hey, Andy, we're getting about 2 out of 3 words, if there's anything you can do to improve that.
Are they good words?
The ones I heard were fine, yeah.
No, I'll just say other jurisdictions have gone through this. HL7B3 messages have been defined, for example, by the UK, or sealed envelopes that are in the domain, but that work would need.
Uh-oh. There goes Andy. Andy, if you can hear us, we can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Carry on without me.
Okay, sorry. You were sort of momentarily back, so if you can improve your reception, we appreciate your input. And we have Denise Webb. Welcome back, Denise.
Hello, everyone. So I've been just kind of listening, catching up, and wanted to say that I'm in full agreement with all the points that Sasha made. And on the point about a standard, you know, obviously I'm not aware of any in healthcare, but having my military background, we did do labeling, security labeling electronically. It's been a while since I've been out of the military. I imagine they've advanced quite a bit on that from a digital perspective, but we might gather some lessons from the DOD on that.
Thank you.
This is Jonathan.
Yes, please.
I apologize. Just to interject on a point of reference, I know standard, the term standard can be used differently, but there is an HL7 standard, a normative standard for data segmentation for privacy, and within that there's a definition of the value sets for applying security labels to CCDAs. So normal, restricted, and very restricted are called out in that normative standard, if that's helpful.
So that's just CCDA, though. That's only CCDA.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
And what's difficult to standardize, if I can jump in on that, is to any individual patient, a very different subset of their clinical data might fit into one of those labels to say, this is very sensitive to me. I'm an airline pilot and my visual acuity is very sensitive to me. I'm an HIV activist, an AIDS activist, and my HIV status is not sensitive to me. That's where it gets really tricky. Not coming up with the categories, but coming up with the mapping of the data to the category for individual patients.
Thank you. Noam Art.
Just sort of for completeness, I just wanted to mention, there are other approaches to this that have been conceived of and tried that isn't tagging. I mean, we did a project with UIUC funded by one of the ONC SHARP grants in the not too distant past, where we sort of approached this not with tagging, but as essentially a clinical decision support exercise. So if we had a CCDA, or I guess it was a CCD at the time, and a consent directive from a patient, could we redact a CCD based on the patient's consent directive to remove the things that the patient didn't want to share in that transaction? So it is a very different approach, because you weren't sending a tag document and hoping that the recipient didn't look at what they weren't supposed to look at, right? I mean, there's something to me that's somewhat flawed in that whole approach. So there are other possible ways to do this. And frankly, I've never been convinced that the whole tagging approach would ever work. It's just my opinion.
Thank you.
The reason you need tagging it in some cases is that the downstream behavior depends on where the data came from. So 42 CFR Part 2 restrictions on redisclosure. So I agree with Noam's point that it would be ideal to make these decisions at runtime based on the patient's current wishes, but you also need the tags in some cases for this other information, although you could maybe say that's provenance, really.
But there may be cases, too, where even if the patient doesn't want something shared, it has to be shared because the law requires it. So then the tagging would have to come into play.
Well, in that case, maybe even the tagging's irrelevant. I mean, if the law says you have to share it, that's it.
But then what does
the
person do who receives it on redisclosure? I mean, I think that's where the issue, where you first send it, then what are they allowed to do with it?
I can see where the two things are not, it's not, what are the patient's wishes? Doesn't determine whether the data is tagged or not. It depends on how you're using tagging and what the roles are, getting back to the Sasha list of three. Andy, you have your hand raised again.
Yeah, just quickly, if you can hear me, I suggest we table these comments and let the task force work it through, hopefully. I think when we're using the term tagging, we just mean identifying. Let's not be prescriptive as to how at this point. Just identify data and handle it appropriately.
Well, and I think we've captured a fair amount of uncertainty, which may be the key message for ONC, is that there's uncertainty, there's not a lot of experience, there's a lack of standards, and that sounds like maybe the kind of feedback that they needed. Not to wimp out. Can we transition, any objections to transition to certificate, authority, backup, and recovery? I'll wait for a moment to give folks a chance to object before we move on. Meanwhile, I will direct people to 6.2.9, which is a mere one sentence. And I was trying to remember how this got on the list, and it may have been Arian, who is not available with us today, but it may have been someone else. The one sentence, which is at, again at 6.2.9, is that each QHIN who is an issuer of certificates shall maintain backup copies of system, database, and private keys in order to rebuild the certificate authority's capability in the event of software and/or data corruption. What I remember from the last time was, again, it may have been Arian or someone else that said, oh, I don't think that's a good idea at all. And here we are for discussion. David, and then Andy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of whether QHINs should be certificate authorities is highly questionable. I'm not sure why you would do that, number one. And number two, if you were a certificate authority, you will have a whole lot more obligations than is captured in 6.2.9 by your certificate policy, which just goes on for hundreds of pages sometimes. So I don't know why this belongs in there at all, frankly.
If you could extrapolate, you mean because there is no requirement for a QHIN to be an issuer of certificates, you're suggesting that having this one quasi-random requirement doesn't really fit. Is that a misrepresentation of your comment?
No, that's pretty good. Quasi-random, I like that.
And thank you, David. Andy, something to add?
Yeah, so I agree with David that it seems a bit orphaned here. Was there a purpose why this was added? It does seem to me that in the event that a QHIN is also a certificate authority, then I would expect its certificate policy to also mandate, you know, I assume this was around Diffie-Hellman tripartite keys held in three remote places so you can recreate the security world. If so, it would make sense that it does do that and doesn't deliberately not enable that security world to be rebuilt. But that's the only thing I can think of as to why this was put in here in a quasi-random fashion.
Anyone representing the ONC want to comment on the rationale for why this is here?
So, Jonathan, I know it's not a fact-based question, but do you recall any comments or anything that pointed us to including this?
No, I don't, Zoe. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I really
That's
don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, so I sense we may have a recommendation that politely says we may suggest deleting this. Is that an overstatement?
No, John, I think there is a legitimate reason for here that if
okay.
the QHIN is a CA, then it must, that it's responsible for maintaining its own root keys. And it can't elect to not manage the root keys and just delete them.
Is it,
but wouldn't it be covered in their requirements as a certificate authority?
No, not to. Your certificate policy, you can actually say, no, I don't want our root keys, I'm not going to keep them. We do that. And I actually have some CAs where I cannot create the security world. But I think this is saying you have to do that. That's the one bit you can't opt out of.
Okay. But it does seem rather orphan here, because if you look at 6.2.7, the title of that is Certificate Policies, but when you read what the sentence says, it's talking about the QHIN security policy requiring that the participant certificates meet or exceed criteria in the QHIN technical framework. And that's all it says, so it's almost kind of misleading where it says certificate policies. You kind of expect that you're going to read something more here about if the QHIN is a CA.
So, Mike, I guess what I was hearing, and David, I see you have your hand raised, so let me sneak in a quick comment, and then we'll get to David. What I was hearing was QHINs aren't required to be certificate authorities, but if they are, then there's reasons to have this in here, but there's probably a reason to have a whole bunch of other stuff. And so if you just have this one thing, does that feel weird or incomplete? And so is our recommendation, I know we're going to draft these, but I'm trying to get us as far down there as we can. Our recommendation isn't take this out. Our recommendation is that maybe this is reasonable if a QHIN chooses to be a certificate authority, but it feels like one of several requirements that we would place on QHINs in that circumstance. And then John Kansky would add, are we being too prescriptive or is that necessary? And I don't, I'm, I, yeah. David, and then Andy again.
Yeah, I think my hand was accidentally left up, but I would agree with what you just said. I think this is a technical detail that would be RCE area of responsibility. I'm not sure what the policy goal is here to enumerate these particular subset of requirements. If it could be translated into a policy goal, maybe that makes sense, but otherwise leave it to the RCE to figure out specifics of a certificate policy.
So that authority. changes the Kansky undiplomatic recommendation of take it out to leave it to the RCE, which is a more diplomatic version of take it out. Is there pushback from Andy or others on that idea? And Andy, you conveniently have your hand up.
Yeah, actually, I am going to push back slightly. I think that this is here with a perfectly legitimate reason of saying, if you're going to be your own certificate authority, you make sure that you can recreate the security world. And we can rephrase that as a policy objective. That's fine, too. If I think through what RFC 3647 has around certificate policies, I think it is, the rest of the stuff, no, that's up to you to determine, even CRLs. But the this one, we don't want a certificate authority to be used that you can't recreate the world for. I think we would all agree with that, and it's a policy statement.
So I think earlier you called it a bit orphaned. Do you feel that there's other requirements that would be on par with this one that are missing, or not so much?
It's a bit orphaned when I look at the context of the rest of the TEF. The only thing I can think of, and David, you might want to, or Jonathan, you might want to comment on this, is around CRLs, certificate revocation lists.
To me, this is just a narrow little sliver of a much broader problem, and I'm not sure I understand why this narrow little sliver is in here. But I don't think it's going to cause any harm. I don't think anybody would remotely accept a certificate from a certificate authority that didn't follow these rules. It's kind of like a no-brainer.
Okay, so I think there'll be a little bit of wordsmithing in our future, but to your point, not a giant controversy.
Yeah.
Denise has her hand up.
Controversy.
Sorry if I said it wrong.
I was just
going to
say that, Andy, I liked Andy's version of the recommendation where instead of being so prescriptive here and tell them, you know, that they have to maintain backup copies of all these things, to rather focus on the policy goal of being able to recreate the security environment if there is an event that causes corruption.
So, yeah, okay, so and I think we're capturing it, but I like that. It sounds like the recommendation is going to be elevate this to a rational policy recommendation and leave the details to the RCE.
Right. And then where the RCE could specify what they expect them to be doing to recreate their security environment.
It took like
or have it in their policies.
It took like 10 minutes of discussion, but I think I finally appreciate the sentiment of the group on this one. Anything else to comment before we move on to identity proofing and authentication? And while I'm waiting for a response, I'll direct folks to 6.2.4. Hearing no objections, my understanding, the identity proofing is, and I'm going to appeal to Zoe or somebody else, is there a participant and participant member analog to 6.2.4? I'm fumbling for it now.
Yeah, there is. I'm looking for it, too. It should be 7.9. Yeah, 7.9 and 7.10 and 8.9 and 8.10. And then there's even another, it's basically just rewritten again in Section 9. In 9.3 and 9.4, but those are basically just rewrites of what was in the previous version.
So I apologize if I'm grossly oversimplifying, but it basically says that at each level, whichever the we need to add it specifies IAL2 minimum for identity proofing, and it apparently applies at the participant member and QHIN level. My question was, it may be answered and I missed it, was are we okay to accept the identity proofing of folks down the tree? If we're a QHIN, can a QHIN accept the identity proofing of a participant member handed to it through one of its participants?
I mean, it has to, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, how could it be otherwise? So, is that assumption? I mean, is that stated overtly, or, and I missed it, or is that just a completely rational assumption per Andy's comment? Question to ONC.
I don't know that that's stated specifically anywhere, but I do believe it is a rational assumption.
Okay. So in terms of the right levels, and I don't remember who posed that question, is that a question of whether IAL2 is sufficient or too stringent, or does anyone have a comment regarding that level of identity proofing?
So I think the question came from Arian, and I might ask Jonathan to just like maybe give a brief overview of what those two levels require. I think Arian had a question on the previous call about just what the new version of NIST, like how the new levels and the IALs and the AALs compare with the LOA requirements in the previous version, and just wanting to double check and confirm that this was, you know, these are the newest levels that we should be looking at.
Jonathan, is there any comment that you have, I think, based on Zoe's question?
Not specifically. So I think, you know, the identity assurance levels are described in NIST 863, and IAL2 supports the real-world existence of the claimed identity. So I think that there is a, you know, there's a sense there that there's a moderate degree of confidence that the person is who they are. And back to the earlier discussion on that, I think the burden is on the entity that is issuing the credential to make sure that that identity assurance level has been attained at the time that the credentials are issued, whatever level that happens to be. Excuse me, whatever tier in the TEF that organization happens to be, whether it be a QHIN or a participant, for example.
And when I read this, and there's an example in the draft of a, for example, what it would take to conform to IAL2. I was not familiar with the standard. I talked to our security guy because our organization has over 50,000 users, and as he didn't think it was unreasonable as long as we could, as we suggested earlier, accept the identity proofing of our participants. That wasn't, it would require effort, maybe inclusion in participation agreements, but that it was not necessarily problematic. Okay, so it appears uncontroversial, although, Andy, you can tell me how I'm supposed to say that. Andy's got your hand up.
Yeah, I was just going to say that we shouldn't comment around registration authorities and issuing authorities and only marginally on certificate authorities, because that's detail about how this is implemented. I think we should just say that, you know, in the QHIN agreement with the RCE, there will be a trust arrangement made or something like that. Jonathan, you can say it better than I can.
I think you said it very well. Thank you.
Well, you're biased, old chap.
What about the authentication, which is also called out for comment here, and when Zoe was quoting 7.9 and 7.10, 8.9 and 8.10, there's also 6.25 that they all are sort of paired, and it calls out for AAL2, which is a authentication level that I believe, among other things, implies two-factor authentication. Is that appropriate, workable? Anyone have a comment in that regard? I don't believe the industry is going to two-factor and people are getting used to two-factor. That seems like a perhaps necessary but higher bar in terms of usability. I'm just talking to try and provoke an opinion. Are we implying here that any participant, member, or QHIN, anyone who authenticates into what is going to be required to conform to AAL2, which includes two-factor every time they log in?
This is Jonathan. Just as a point, I think that the definition of AAL2 certainly does include multi-factor authentication, but it can include a combination of two single-factor authenticators as well. So there is some, I guess, wiggle room there if you don't want to be doing two-factor authentication on the, you know, at that point in time.
Thank you, Andy.
So wiggle room being you don't do two-factor authentication. Just two instances of the same factor. Marvelous.
is there a national standard for authentication in healthcare environments right now that I'm unaware of?
Was that directed to Jonathan?
Well, anybody who cares to answer, David, Jonathan, ONC people, you're the gurus.
Well, I apologize. I didn't hear the question. It broke up a little bit on me.
I'm asking, is there a national standard for authentication to health IT systems in the US that I was unaware of?
Not to my knowledge. I would have to look into that, but I'm not aware of one on the top of my head.
So there's nothing like EGF or anything like that?
I think that there are some requirements in certification for EHRs and for patient portals to be able to support some of these standards. I'm not sure that there's an actual requirement that you use them. My concern here would be that the policy decision is whether or not accessing the federated record should have different required authentication and identity proofing than accessing any other record. So, for example, if I'm an individual exercising my individual right of access through a patient portal, I would have a certain standard in place, this put in place by that provider's organization. If I go through a participant in a QHIN through the TEF and get all of that data plus all of the rest of my data in other places, should there be a need for a higher level given the potentially greater breadth of information being gathered? I think my personal answer is no, they should both be at a high level because the data is so sensitive. But I think that would be the policy question, is are you trying to set a different standard than would be in effect for providers accessing their own records or patients accessing their own data segregated by a certain provider? And I think this is consistent with how all access should be. So this makes good sense to me.
Okay. Yeah, my simplistic assumption in reading this was this is the authors of TEFCA wanting to say that we expect user authentication to be at this minimum level, whether that's the rest of the industry or not. This is just makes good sense. That was my inference. Just echoing you, David.
Yeah, I think this is an area where we'll see a fair amount of change over the next couple of years. So, NIST has, I think, very wisely left it in a form that doesn't specify which technology is used. We're going to see proliferation of digital identities. The Karen conference is going on as we speak about that. So the technical standards will be changing, but requiring this abstract higher level of two-factor makes good sense to me, regardless of what technology emerges to make two-factor easier to do.
Help me out, anybody. I'm trying to develop my instincts. So in the world where the TEFCA ecosystem exists and is in place, is this creating sort of a de facto? If one has to conform to AAL2 authenticating users for anybody who's going to have access to data through the TEFCA ecosystem, you've sort of de facto created that standard for anybody who's logging into any EHR or about anything in the a patient portal, a HIE portal, et cetera, because it's going to be not make sense to have two levels of authentication. So are we creating a de facto national floor for authentication by including this, or did I go off the deep end?
Well, I think that it's not a bad thing to do that if that's the side effect that it has, although given that at least for the near term, the amount of data that will flow through these channels, TEF channels, versus the data that flows through other channels that won't be affected by TEF, I don't know that this tail will wag that dog anytime soon.
Thank you. Andy, you have a comment?
Blocking task force was very clear that we wanted to allow local organizations to have local policies, and that those are the governing policies. So I would suggest that whether information is being sourced from near or from afar, it should be a consistent approach to controlling access to that information. And then it's a decision for the QHIN in the participation agreements about allowing organizations to connect depending on the security policies that they have in place at a local level.
So are you suggesting this is too prescriptive to the QHINs, or did I miss your point entirely?
So, local organizations.
Can you start over? You're breaking up.
I'm agreeing with you.
Okay.
It should be in the participation agreements between QHIN and a local organization, and it's up to them to agree. Different between a certain minimum level the QHIN defines.
So I'm detecting a perhaps difference of opinion. On the one hand, I think I understood David to say, yeah, this seems reasonable to state. And then, Andy, I hear you saying perhaps that it's too prescriptive. We're supposed to be trying to allow intra-QHIN policies to be set by the QHIN. Am I trying to pick a fight where there isn't one, or is there a different
kind of, David made a good point there, which is, are we treating data which is out of my local EMR different to data that's come from afar? There is nothing that says whether data is local versus foreign that determines whether that data is more or less sensitive.
I completely agree.
Well, on the other hand, I think finding a nationally sanctioned network, using a nationally sanctioned network based on new law as a way to lift the expectation for access to the complete federated medical record makes a lot of sense. And if there are local institutions who have lower standards, they probably ought to worry about that.
And they shouldn't be connected to the national federated record.
Right, because they can't meet the standard.
Yeah, we agree. We agree on that. But you shouldn't have a different level.
I think we can't. We, ONC, can't tell those entities how to behave. They tried that in meaningful use and didn't get it through. Maybe this is a chance to do it, to push a little harder on a national level. I mean, do you access anything sensitive today without two-factor? I can't
yes.
authorize my Adobe Photoshop without two-factor, for goodness sake. surely your health record should be two-factor.
David, if only every provider organization that I'm aware of believed as you do.
Well, that's why we're here.
So I guess the observation or comment from at least what my offering would be, we're observing that this is not an inappropriate level, but that the industry may not be at this level yet, and so just so ONC has a awareness, so we agree that there shouldn't be two standards, that this standard that's suggested here is reasonable, but acknowledging that it's going to drive some change in the industry because two-factor is not everywhere yet. That was there's some Kansky embedded in that poorly worded recommendation or comment, but others, I'm sure, will fix it. Mark Savage has his hand up.
Yeah, I just want to affirm what David said about two-factor authentication. It may have been said on this, but the various privacy and security task forces and Tiger teams that have looked at this issue have all been at two-factor I think the question has been whether it would go beyond 2 to 2.5 or more, but definitely two factor. It seems it's hard to imagine how we could go backwards.
Thank you. Andy's back. Andy?
Sorry, I was on mute. I'm not proposing we go backwards, Mark. My suggestion here is purely that we don't allow some kind of two-track system to emerge where access to local electronic health records is somehow under a reduced level of integrity than access to third-party source health records. That doesn't seem to be what we should be doing here. Now, I completely agree that we might want to say, okay, if you're going to be part of, if you're connected to a QHIN, then your local security policy needs to be for two-factor authentication. That I could go with, but not a two-track. That just seems wrong.
I think we're agreeing.
So when you say local, do you mean internal?
Within the locally, I'm trying to not get into logical versus physical, but the EMR that I use on my desktop.
I don't know, Andy. I don't know that participation in a QHIN should dictate anything about how the local EMR authentication works. And if folks wanted to implement a second layer of authentication for access to external data, sort of like they might have second layers of authentication for access to sensitive data or for e-prescribing of controlled substances or other actions, it doesn't seem like this is the right group to over-prescriptively rule that out.
I agree with that. So, however, I'm not sure that we should be also saying, you should have a second level of authentication, because just the sheer usability aspects then would be of concern.
So then
I certainly think that we should be mindful of usability.
Thank you. Yeah, so I guess what I hear the compromise position being calling out AAL2 is good, but not requiring, not being prescriptive in terms of we shouldn't create a recommendation that implies that should also be applied locally. We should leave that autonomy open.
Well, I mean, I think that TEF has nothing to say about what happens locally outside the TEF, right? So if a provider wants his portal to have no passwords at all, he could probably run into somebody who's upset, but it's not going to be TEF or the RCE. TEF only pertains to participation in this particular network through these rules, which is very different from what local decisions are around patient portals. So it's moot point as to what the impact of this is on portals. I'm just saying that just because some institutions haven't got the stomach to go two-factor for their portal access doesn't mean we shouldn't elevate the bar for the TEF, which is a new thing and a much more powerful thing in the long run because it's the whole record. I don't think it matters what TEF doesn't affect what local institutions do. What they do locally, I should say. I didn't get the adjective in the right place.
I understand. Andy.
I think we should be very, very cautious about this because we may well create this two-tier I'm talking about. And we want TEF to be something which is, you know, frankly, borderline transparent, I thought, to the end user. So that clinicians have a richer set of information around which to make clinical decisions. And putting extra authentication gates in the way is not necessarily a smart way of getting adoption.
I'm trying to listen to the and learn from the discussion. What I'm hearing, channeling Sasha's comment, is that, yeah, it sounds like two levels is bad, but we're not going to tell, you know, we want to keep usability, we want to consider usability. Having two different tiers of authentication is bad, so hopefully people won't be silly enough to do that. But at the same time, we don't want to, channeling Mark, lower the standard below what's being implied here. So if you're going to reach inside the TEFCA ecosystem for data, you're going to have to meet the standard. If you don't have the stomach to raise your systems to that standard, then that's on you.
And yeah, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with, yeah, this is David. I think particularly when it comes to privacy and security, there's nothing wrong with raising the bar, particularly when you're really raising it to community norms for all other kinds of sensitive data. Your bank, your, you know, Facebook login, my goodness, it's two factors everywhere now. I switched cell phones recently in this transition from work to retirement, and I had to reset up a dozen different two-factor accounts on the new phone. It was a pain in the butt, but that's the norm now. Now, there'll be technology to make that easier in the future, but I don't think we should shy away from holding access to your complete federated record to a higher bar than perhaps local standards currently do. But I think we probably
David,
need this one to death.
David, no one's shying away from anything. I'm just not sure.
I'm sorry, Andy. I didn't mean to make that to sound pejorative. I think two-tier in some cases when you're raising the bar is a policy goal that's a good one. Other cases, two-tier is a bad one. You know, if you have a network that's fractured because you can't all agree on network security protocols, that's a problem. If we get, you know, a higher bar of privacy for patient data, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's I think we're probably close to agreement, actually.
We normally are. And I could sound snarkier if you want.
Likewise. We're both capable.
We've descended into snarky, so I think it's time to move on. Have we exhausted discussion on this particular point? I assert that we have. Okay, we've got about 5 minutes before public comment. So we're now at tier three. Let me prompt Zoe, because I believe we talked about auditable events yesterday, but I don't want to gloss over that. Did we cover that sufficiently in yesterday's call?
I think we did cover auditable events in yesterday's call, unless anybody has anything additional they want to add to that. Organizational identity, I'm not. We talked about it for a minute when we were going over the security provisions, but unless somebody from the group wants to sort of remind us what they wanted to discuss there, I didn't have anything to add to that. And then the last one was just notes that I've been taking on consent as a broader issue, not on any particular provision. So,
got it. Is there any anybody want to? All right, so let me give you a couple options. Is there any rule that says we can't go to public comment a few minutes early?
No, we could go to comment right now if you'd like, John.
Why don't we take this break in the action to do that?
Operator, can you open the line?
If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue, and you may press *2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Are there any calls in there?
None at this time.
Okay, thank you. John?
Thank you. So, Zoe or others, how should we make use of our last 13 minutes? I can throw it open and say, okay, look at the list top to bottom, start going back to tier one perhaps, and say anybody who missed a call or woke up at 2 a.m. with a burning new comment that they hadn't made earlier, and prompt the group for anybody wanting to touch again on something we discussed earlier. I'll pause there for just a moment. And while you're pondering that, I believe the expectation, and I need to get with Zoe and Arian, so don't hold me to this, although you may have to hold me to this. The intent is to take what we've got here and come up with a draft version one recommendations document that we will circulate in advance of the June 11th call. And then the June 11th call will be spent starting to hammer the draft comments into a progressively more final form. Zoe, is that consistent with what we discussed?
Yep, I think that that makes sense. So we have a full work group call or full committee call, I think June, is it 17th, where we'll hopefully be in a place to present, it's June 19th, where we'll hopefully be in a place to present our draft recommendations. And then the last full committee call is July 11th. So we can hopefully do our final recommendations then and vote. I'll also add, we don't have any meetings set up right now for after June 19th. So we'll probably be adding meetings to people's calendars, ideally by the end of the day. And then I guess one, the last thing, I'd maybe prompt Gnome to maybe provide any recommendation or comment on some of the public health things in the TEFCA. I don't believe that we got into a long conversation about public health in your absence, Gnome, and I know that there were some specific points that you wanted to make.
Yeah, I'll try to do that. You know, frankly, it's difficult to look back at the matrix whose notes in the right-hand column are a bit cryptic, or in some cases, there's nothing there at all. So it's really hard to figure out what the task force talked about when I wasn't there. Just as a point of comment.
Yeah, and so we're doing our best to capture everything. So I will remind everybody that we do have the cell team takes notes after every call and posts them to the main HITECH website. So you can take a look at those notes. This matrix is available on Google Docs, and I believe the link was sent to folks, so you guys can take a look at the matrix. We also have transcripts from the calls, which I will be poring over for the rest of the week and attempting, and with John and Arian, hopefully, to clean up this matrix to make it a bit more readable and actually, you know, plug in what recommendations we've heard and captured on the calls so far.
So, Zoe, are those transcripts just available to you and we just get the summarized notes on the web? Because just like with Gnome, I mean, I wasn't on a number of the calls because I was out of the country.
Yeah, Katie, can we please send the transcripts along with the notes? And are those being posted to the website?
Yes, they are.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Mark, you have your hand raised.
Yes, thanks. So this falls in the category of perhaps a new issue, or perhaps I totally missed it and spaced on a previous call, but jumping back and forth with the recent comment letters to ONC and CMS and this on TEFCA, I'm thinking about how standardized Firebase APIs might fit into TEFCA. As I quickly skimmed a few minutes ago to try to do some intelligence gathering, it seems like there's some leaning in that direction because that's the way things are going, but not a requirement. There's a reference someplace to working with your existing infrastructure. So I'm wondering if somebody can confirm what TEFCA does or doesn't say on that. And if it's not a requirement, to just put the question out there, should we be thinking about that issue?
Sure. So I might put a note try to distinguish a little bit when we talk about APIs. I think what we are really trying to distinguish between is document exchange versus resource-based exchange, right? So we currently, in the TEFCA and in the QHIN technical framework, we specify IHE profiles only. Of course, there can be IHE-based APIs that support document exchange. I think what we're really trying to explore is sort of that distinction. Right now, and I think that there are purposes and value to both being able to exchange documents like CCDAs and also being able to just pull, you know, a resource or, you know, your meds list, for example. Currently, the QHIN technical framework, it adapted what was already out there in the industry and what was found in implementation guides that are out there today. And so we took our cues from what's out there today and what's being implemented already. We know that there are initiatives happening, like both Commonwealth and Care Quality have convened work groups around fire APIs. And so we definitely, you know, we definitely do not want to, you know, trounce on that work. And, you know, ideally as that progresses, that's something that the RCE will be able to work with the industry to determine, you know, when it's ready to be added, whether as a requirement or, you know, just an allowance for QHINs to use. But currently as drafted, the QTF supports IHE profiles only.
So I would just add as a placeholder that even if you don't feel the industry is there now, and I understand that now still might be the time to express an expectation for what's going to happen. So you have a proposed regulation that talks about being ready by January 1st, 2022, for example. So I guess what I'm putting out there right now is maybe this is a good topic for a short conversation or reflection in the future. I don't have my own thoughts made up about it. And I appreciate your summary, Zoe. That really helps. Thank you.
David has his hand raised. David, you still there?
Yeah, sorry, I was muted. An uncommon thing. I would just want to second what Zoe said. I think that logic makes a lot of sense. If the goal is to take advantage of existing networks and rope them under a common agreement so they can keep doing what they're doing and doing it better and more with more widespread, widely available connections, it makes sense to start with those document-based exchanges. I think the pressure in the long run from the individual participants in the RCE will be to shift in the direction of more of simpler API approaches, but I don't think anybody wants to start over before the first information flows through the TEF. That would be my argument or my position. It's good thinking.
Thank you. Andy.
Yeah, I agree with David. I think we need to be thoughtful about how we will promote advancement as well.
So this is Mark, just to ask, are both of you thinking we shouldn't be talking now about whether to talk about a placeholder for the future? Is there a both and here?
I don't know. I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, my belief is that the only thing you would consider is saying don't do it, but since you're not saying don't do it, the RCE has the authority, I think it would have the authority to work with the stakeholders and move in that direction. In other words, I think it's going to happen one way or the other. I don't mind putting a statement in or something that says be aware of rapid evolution in the APIs. I think maybe more to the point would be aware of the new requirements from the CURES NPRM and stay consistent with those so that you don't make vendors do double work and have to implement the same service in two different ways from scratch.
Right.
So I worry more about consistency with the API requirements in the broader 21st century cures context than I do about TEF not getting to APIs. I think they will, or to Firebase APIs.
Well,
yeah. We need to make sure you lockstep with cures. But what we don't inadvertently do is create some kind of resting ground where we continue with quote standards unquote that may be less mature and less modern, I suppose.
Go ahead.
I'm done. That's enough.
And I'm just trying to bring us in for a landing at the appointed time. Thanks to everyone for the active dialogue. Much appreciated. We got through the things we were trying to get through. Now the ball squarely back in the court of the co-chairs and ONC, and we'll try to turn around something that you guys can comment on. With that, Zoe, anything else before we, or Lauren, anything else we need to touch on?
Nothing for me.
Nothing. Thank you.
Okay, thanks all. Talk to you next week.
Take care.
Thanks very much. Bye.